netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. Well, this week, John Montgomery is talking to Gareth Edwards about his new film, Monsters. Now, this is a really interesting project. It's interesting at a whole bunch of levels. I think there are three things that struck me as being tremendous about this project. The first thing is an independent film. It's got international release, but it is very much an independent film. It's extraordinarily well-shot film, but because it was independent and the way they did it, kind of traveling through South America, they tended to mold the plot to what they could film, which produces a really amazing array of visuals. The second thing is that, perhaps surprisingly, it's actually available now on iTunes before its theatrical release. So obviously feel free to go and see it at the cinemas, but if you want to watch it in HD, you can actually do that off the iTunes store now, depending on what region you're in. And the other thing that I think makes it really extraordinary, and certainly we've seen this before because Gareth has actually done courses over at FX PhD highlighting projects that he's worked on where he's done this before. Gareth is pretty much the visual effects department, turning in some 250 shots over 5 months. The guy is a terrific filmmaker, but has also marvelous opinions on independent filmmaking, the nature of visual effects, and just where the industry is heading. And apart from anything else, it's just fascinating to hear how he got this film up and made so quickly. And it's a very funny and very good interview. Let's cross to John now.
Well, you know what? I thought it would be great just to kind of talk about this whole story and the making of the film, because I think it's quite interesting from a, you know, one could call it rebel filmmaking standpoint. But why don't we start out just with the story process and kind of how you started working with the script and creating the story? I mean, did you have it fully scripted from the start?
No, literally. I mean, I've always wanted to. I think a lot of visual effects people ultimately are frustrated filmmakers or wannabe filmmakers, or however you describe it. And I was one of those. I just always wanted to make movies. That's the only reason I got into visual effects. And I kept putting it off and putting it off. But the whole time I had a career doing computer graphics, I was constantly on the lookout for an idea that could work, that I could afford to probably finance myself and do really cheaply. And I remember this one occasion, like if you're going to stick visual effects in the background of footage, there's a few genres that it really works for, like obviously like alien invasion, monster movies, zombies, things like that. And so I was on holiday and I was watching these fishermen and they were pulling this net in from the ocean. And I was trying in my head loads of different monster movie type scenarios. And I just thought, I wonder what's on the end of this net. I bet it, you know, let's imagine it's this giant sea creature that's dead or something. And so I'm like watching their hands and imagining I'm filming it and thinking, how hard would it be to rotoscope around that and add in a CGI dead creature? And something interesting happened, which is the men obviously can't see this. So they're carrying on like it's completely normal, like an everyday event. And I was thinking, this is really interesting. What kind of world is that, where a giant monster, you know, washing up on the shore or whatever, is part of everyday life? And so I spent the rest of the holiday and then all the time afterwards picturing other things, like if there was a roadblock in the road, imagine an upturned tank or something like this, as if there'd been a battle, and started to realize that you could make a film really low budget, really cheaply, by just going to some exotic location, shooting, and I could stick things in afterwards, and the fact that everyone was ignoring it just made the world feel more real, just in the sense of, like, I wanted to begin a monster movie where all monster movies normally end. Like, at the end of, like, Godzilla or King Kong, when King Kong crashes down, like, how do they clear that up? Like, how do you get rid of that carcass? Do they chop it into pieces? You know, do diggers come and, like, whose job is that? And I really, like, I found that world more interesting than the ones that have been done 100 times. And so that was my starting point. I didn't really have a story. But the great thing is if you have an idea that's slightly commercial and very, very cheap to make, you're going to find someone who'll give you the cash to make it. You don't actually, in the end, have to spend your own money. And the first people I went to see was Vertigo Films in the UK, and they were brilliant. They instantly, well, James, actually, who's the producer, he said, I was so paranoid that I wasn't going to get to make the movie. I mean, everyone I knew that was a director was developing a film. You know, they all are, and no one actually makes anything. Everyone's just working on a script or knows someone who knows someone. So I was paranoid it wasn't going to happen. They were just saying it. And so he said, okay, write on this piece of paper a date that you want to start filming. And out of fear, I wrote something just 3 months away. And annoyingly, he stuck to the date. And so I had 3 months to come up with how the story was, cast the film, you know, where we were going to film it, all that sort of thing. And so it was very much like, it's a monster movie first. Now, what the hell is it about? And we had to figure out the rest afterwards.
So you basically came up with this story idea. And then basically did a rough outline, right, before you went. You filmed this one in Central and South America and Mexico, but you kind of had a rough outline and not a line-by-line scripting, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe we did this. I don't believe this is the film we made at all, but our mission statement that I put on the front of the document that we made was, in quotes, the world's most realistic monster movie. It was like, every time I had a big decision to make about do we go left or right, I always tried to take the one that the world's most realistic film would do. And so for me, that involved, at one point, it was going to be even a documentary. It wasn't going to have any actors or anything. And we're just going to film real people, go to a real place, and manipulate all their answers, stick things in, and just make it look like this. There's a world that's been turned upside down by these creatures. The problem with that is the whole reason I'm doing it is because I want to be a filmmaker, and I didn't want to get to the end of the process and have people say, oh, yeah, great little documentary, Gareth, well done. And then I say, can I make a movie now? And they say, no, you do documentaries, you know, make another one. And I wanted it to be a drama in that sense, so I wasn't stuck in that box. And so we had two actors at the heart of the film that we found, Scoot and Whitney. And essentially everybody else in the film, to keep it feeling realistic, are real people that we met along the way. And we essentially, it's a road movie really in a way. And we did the trip that the characters do in the film, and we were all fitted into the back of a van. It was very guerrilla. I was filming it myself. We had a sound man, a line producer, and a Spanish equivalent, and that was essentially the crew for most of it. And we just kind of did the journey the characters do and would jump out, pick a scene, you know, maybe have a conversation, maybe not, because it'd often be more realistic if even the actors didn't quite know what was going to happen next. And we would just shoot it, and then obviously it became a very painful process in the edit, getting all these hours of footage down to whatever ultimately was this 90-minute film.
Well, it's actually really great because you can actually, in your travels, actually find places that look like maybe they're the result of a battle or worn down or burned out or something like that. And so you must have run into a ton of those along the way, actually.
We kept telling the whole time to the local people that we're with, we kept saying, if there's anything weird or strange or just slightly unusual, please, please tell us, and because we'll go and shoot there. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. And so there's loads of examples in the film of all sorts of things like this, like... whilst we were there over Halloween, and there was a thing called the Day of the Dead Festival, where Mexicans, they remember their dead family members by going to the graves, lighting candles, cooking a meal, and they spend the night next to the graves. And it's the most beautiful sight in certain, this one particular town outside of Mexico City. It's just beautiful, all these like thousands of candles in the middle of nowhere. And so we went and filmed it, but when we were filming it, had no idea how it would work in the movie at the time. It just looked so good, we had to use it. And so then in the edit, it was kind of one of the ideas that I wanted to have in the film was that there was protests about the bombing campaign on the creatures because they were killing a lot of civilians. And so what it did was in the computer, I could basically add graffiti and banners and things like this. So amongst all these, this candlelit vigil, as it were, it turned into a protest. And it looks like a really big number. Like you watch it in the film and it's like, how did they get thousands of people to come to this place, this town, and demonstrate against all the people that have been killed in the war. But actually it was completely the opposite way around. We just, whatever looked interesting, we shot it and then figured it out later.
Do you ever concede situations there of people not loving a filming crew coming up? Do you ever run into any issues, especially in filming in a foreign country is kind of dicey?
Yeah, I kept expecting everyone to tell us to go away. If we shot it in London, that's what would have happened. They everyone would have said, do you have permission? You know, what are you doing here? You've got to move on. You can't film this. But in Mexico, it was completely opposite. I honestly don't remember an occasion ever where someone told us to stop filming or someone didn't agree to be in it. And we have release forms for everyone that was in the background or in the foreground or whatever, if they're recognizable. But yeah, I can't speak Spanish, but basically the translator would have a set spiel. Like when we picked a location that we liked the look of or a person that we wanted to be in the film, I'd sort of cross my fingers as she went up to them and did them explain how we were doing. They'd look really nervously at us, like, what is this, a political film? Well, you know, what's going on here? And as soon as she says the word, like, extraterrestrial, they would suddenly, like, smile and go, okay. It's like for some reason, it's very common for people to walk around with cameras and shoot monster movies in Mexico. It's like they all wanted to be in a monster movie. It wasn't a problem.
Wow, this is great. Now, so you traveled effectively with a crew of six, for the most part, apart from some of the bigger scenes in the film with more extras or more talent, but also had an editor along as well. take a look at the stuff after you shot immediately after each day, or how did that work out?
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I love Colin, who's the editor. I love him to death. And he did a phenomenal job on this film. But I think if I, and he knows this, I think if we were to do it again, I wouldn't have taken him with us, because the whole point of the editor, in theory, what they're supposed to do is make you feel secure, because, you know, you're sort of shooting all this stuff, and the idea is that if they watch what yesterday's rush is, and they find out if there's a problem, they let you know before you move on to somewhere else so you can go back and shoot stuff. And you have so much pressure on yourself, especially making this film the way we did, which was like ad-libbing it, doing all your own visual effects, things like that. I was so under such pressure. I felt all this pressure. The last thing I wanted to do was to get home at the end of the shoot, where you only got like 3 hours sleep, and had to spend an hour with someone who tells you what was wrong about yesterday. It was kind of like, ultimately, everything that was, anything that we didn't quite get right, we all solved it all in the edit, in the end anyway, or Colin did. And so, and the other reason for having the editors there was that Colin and his assistant, Justin, was that we were using tapeless format stuff. So that initially is like, oh, brilliant, we don't need tapes, isn't life so much easier? But that actually kind of backfires a little bit, because every day you have to delete the footage that you shot, like this great stuff that you got, like this really happy accidents. You have to have the balls to delete it so you can film the next day. And so that's quite scary. So you want to clone it and check that it worked and there's no corrupt files. And so it actually became more hassle than having tapes in the end, I feel. But
well, that's actually why it's happy. It's useful to have someone there. Mike likes to call it the responsible adult who takes care of making sure that footage does get backed up, is good, yeah, before you delete those cards.
It's funny because Justin, who was the assistant, whose main job it was to clone everything, had to clone everything 3 times.
Yep.
He never saw it. We went on this amazing adventure through Central America. It was like Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, Costa Rica. And he never saw any of it because he was locked all the time in the motel room making 3 copies. And it was even his birthday one day. And as a joke, we bought him 3 of the same birthday cards, and we all signed it exactly identically, so that it was all cloned 3 times, and he didn't find it funny at all.
No, but one of the most important jobs, I think, on your trip was his job, of course.
Sure.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about some of the technical details and then dive into the post on it, because as you touched on, you were doing the visual effects. But I was actually struck by the beauty of the footage, and I was kind of curious. I didn't know, watching the film, what you used camera gear-wise, because you seem to have some nice stuff with really shallow depth of field, very cinematic. What actual physical gear were you using to film with that?
It was a Sony EX3 with a Litus Ultimate adapter on the front, and it was just SLR lenses that screw onto that. Mainly used the Nikon 50mm at f1.2 for people who care about these things.
Very much so, because you really did use a lot of shallow depth of field in it to drive some of the story home, I think.
I think to be honest, that was the missing link in the holy grail of guerrilla filmmaking, was that prior to all those sort of developments, if you wanted to go and make a low-budget film, you know, and you had no money, the only way you could really do it was to shoot it on video. And then it looks low-budget. It looks like, you know, a very cheap-looking thing. And you know, for me, the thing that makes cinema look so beautiful is the narrow depth of field. Like, if I'm filming you, the background's beautifully out of focus, and so is the foreground. But on normal HD, everything's in focus, and it's all shouting for your attention, and it looks a lot more ugly. It's a lot harder to make things look beautiful that way. And so when these adapters came out, I really felt like, well, that's what we've been waiting for. We've been waiting for like something that I can, you know, you can afford to buy yourself, that is cinema resolution, i.e. HD, but has the beautiful depth of field that 35mm had. The downside is because it isn't expensive as 35mm, we could shoot the hell out of everything. So we ended up with like over 100 hours worth of footage that we had to painfully go through and until we could, like, it took about 8 months to edit the film, basically.
How was it actually confirming the focus on it as well? Because you don't have a lot of depth to have something in focus, but it seemed like, obviously, the stuff in the film, you nailed it. But what was it like to work with that shallow depth of field actually in reality when you're running, gunning, filming on the fly?
I'm so lucky in that I'm one of these people that hate reading manuals. Like, I don't really do it. I just, something so boring about reading a manual. And thank God, just before we left with the camera, the guy showed me this little switch through the viewfinder, and it basically, it's like the Terminator. It makes, when you get something in focus, it puts a red outline around it. And if, I think if you hadn't showed me that, maybe the whole film would be out of focus, but it was one of those things, you could be filming an actor or an actress, and you get really nervous, like, is this in focus? And you dare not turn it, because it's the middle of a great performance, and you think, if I screw this up now by doing a rack focus the wrong way or something. But because of this little switch, I could see their eyes would be like shining red to sort of say that the highlights in their eyes were like exactly in focus. And so it was, and I think it's the problem I would have, I think, if we were to make a film again with, you know, obviously the things like the Canon 5D look really sexy. And I would love to embrace that, but I haven't seen how you get the focus right, because if you get it slightly wrong on a big screen on 35mm, you can, you know, you really pay, you know, you can really tell that you've screwed it up.
Yeah, I was going to say that's really one of the reasons of going with a Sony, I think, worked for you in that situation, especially with that lens choice, because you would have been in tough luck, I think, in a lot of situations. Okay, so you're getting that. For sound, are you just doing minimal crew, so boom mics or wire?
Yeah, it was Ian was our sound guy, and he basically had radio mics on the actors. And he, if we had chance and he had time, he would radio mic anyone, like the non-actors that we bumped into. He would boom it as well. And I think the reason that was so important, as apart from the obvious, was that because they were ad-libbing it, because everyone we met, we could never get hold of them again. They were just random people we bumped into as we were on the journey. The idea of ADRing it all would have been nearly impossible. So we had to get the best quality sound on the day. And I sort of learned that it's quite interesting that if you have a, you can have like really grainy, horrible video footage with great sound and you forgive it because the sound is what gives you the production value in your mind. But when you have, if you have a great image, but the sound is rubbish and really badly recorded, it just makes the whole thing feel cheap. And so I think in terms of production value, weirdly, sound supersedes visuals in a way.
Oh, there's a scene when they're on the river heading back up north to the infected land where there's actually some really nice use of sound where you actually don't see anything. I mean, they're stopped by the side of the river, but it's actually a really impactful scene just done exclusively with sound, I think.
No, cheers. Well, that was actually a complete fluke because, again, this is like another example of being opportunistic, was that we had about 45 minutes. We were in Guatemala on the river in a boat, and we had about 45 minutes to wait. Someone was going to bring us sandwiches by the edge of the river, and it felt sacrilegious on a low-budget film to sit for 45 minutes. So I was like, let's just do something. Let's just, you know, the actors are looking at me like, can't we just rest, you know? And so let's just shoot a scene. And so we're like, let's pretend we're pulling in for gas. And I just had this sense something would happen. I don't know why. And as we get out the boat and we film, Whitney goes to take a piss and everything. And I was kind of just filming them. And then suddenly, in all, you know, basically this howler monkey starts screaming in the distance. And it's the most disturbing sound. It sounds like dropping a baby in a vat of acid or something. I haven't done that for a while, but I remember what it used to sound like. And yeah, it was kind of like this horrific sound comes through the trees, and obviously everyone's reacting to it, like the people I'm filming are reacting to it. And it was suddenly like, yeah, of course we have to have a scene in our film where we don't see the creatures and all we do is hear them and it gets really freaky. And so then we shot it all in one take and then quickly went back and got a few pieces and then went for our sandwiches and it made the movie. But it was never in the script, and there were so many examples of that throughout the film. Of things that just happy accidents. And the way I've sort of tried to view it, my bad analogy, is that the way you normally make a film is you draw a target, you paint a target on the wall, and that's your script. And you stand back, and with a gun, you try and get a bullseye, and that's like shooting the film. Well, with us, we shot the film, so we just shot randomly at the wall, and then wherever it landed, I went up and I painted a bullseye over it. So it's like we just went and filmed and got all this stuff, and then using computer graphics and editing, we tried to turn it into our storyline. And so it looks like we got so lucky when we were filming with all these little random things that happened. But it was actually a lot of hard work in post-production trying to crowbar everything back into the...
But you did have a solid foundation of kind of where you wanted the story to go over the duration of the film, of course. You had the...
So all the emotional beats and the journey of the characters, they were all worked out. But what wasn't locked down was what the location or the environment would look like during that scene or during that moment. And what the dialogue would be. A lot of it was improvised, and that was basically born out of using non-actors. It was, you know, I found you could get a great performance out of non-actors. Like you, no one can play you better than you can. You could do an Oscar-winning performance of you. The trick is not to tell you how to behave and just let you be yourself. So I can't say things like get angry or get upset or anything like that, because it'll just suddenly look rubbish. You just have to say what the parameters of the scene are. Like, don't sell that ferry ticket for less than $5,000 because he'll buy it if he doesn't. And then let them do whatever they want. And so, it's really important to us that the film, for better or for worse, felt like real, and that we were really in that environment and these were real people. And like, because it was true, like, the audience hopefully isn't sure what's going to happen next, because we didn't know what was going to happen next. Like, I'm filming it, like, I don't know what they're going to do. Like, they don't know what they're going to do. And then, so there's this vibe throughout the film, I think, that I hope comes through, is just this sense of slightly realistic, like, not quite sure where this film's going to go sort of thing.
So now, how long did you spend filming principally at all?
Yeah, it was a 6-week shoot.
6 weeks, okay.
Yeah.
6 weeks, and how many hours total of footage?
I think it was just over, a bit over 100 hours.
Okay. So you took all that back to your giant post-production company, I guess, and, which is not the case, though. Tell us about the post-process, because it's quite impressive.
It was all edited on Premiere Pro,
yep.
And we edited it in high def, so we could see it as we were doing it. Colin, my editor, we basically sat with him in, I'd say an office, but it was more like a cupboard, for about 8 months in total. And whilst he was working on it, I'd try and use my little spare moments to chip away at the previews of stuff. And for a long time in the film, we just put text wherever there was going to be visual effects. We'd just stick up some text. And what's funny is, like, we had to try and submit the film. Before we finished it, you have to try and submit the film into festivals, and we were really lucky. South by Southwest took it based on the version that just had text, so they hadn't seen any of the visual effects. It was literally just text everywhere.
Faith.
I know. And so, and it was funny because I got off the plane and I met the guy who was running the festival, Tim League, and he was going. So he stood there and he was really polite. He made a bit of chit chat and then eventually went like, "So did you finish the movie?" You know, and I was like, "That's great. You took you 4 questions before you asked that." And I was saying, yeah, the text is way better now. It's a different font, you know. It's all chrome and reflective. And so he sat and watched it for the first time, like, as we pretty much did, because we literally ejected the tape and flew over, and it was a very last-minute scramble.
Now, you keep saying we. Okay, yeah. Just to be clear, how many people does we refer to?
In terms of what, the visual effects?
Visual effects and...
It was just me.
Okay.
It's like the royal we. I'm from England, so it's the way I talk.
So
it's we if they're bad. If you think they're rubbish, I say we. If you like the look of them, I go I.
So there are how many effect shots in the film? There's considerable number of sequences have visual effects in them in some form or another.
There was about 250.
Okay.
And so I did them over about 5 months. And I think there's like 60 creature shots. But the rest is all things like military vehicles, all the signage in the world. The film setting is all done in Photoshop after the fact. So you just film a real sign and imagine something's on it. And then later, you know, I can track that shot using Mocha and stuff and re-Photoshop in, you know, what the sign should be, etc. And it was basically a case of just having, I use it like an Excel document where it automatically tallies up at the bottom. I put an estimated time it's going to take each shot and it tells you how long you need to finish. And so I make sure that equals 5 months at the start of the process. And then every day I just make sure I do a day's work. And it kind of keeps the fear away, because computers can smell fear. And so it's like, as long as you just stay on target, I know I don't have to worry about all these other shots. I just have to worry about today's piece of work. And I get that done. And it was also very much a case of working in a non-linear way. So instead of making a bunch of shots look really good and some look really bad because you didn't give them the right amount of time, I was trying to make all the shots in the film equally as good as they could be, so that if you suddenly hit that point where someone points a gun at your head and says, step away from the computer, it's like, you know, you've got to leave it now, Gareth. That at least the caliber of every shot would be reasonably equal. It wouldn't be, this is a great sequence, this is a terrible one.
Well, I want to talk a bit more about the specific tools that you mentioned there, but you know, obviously one of the bigger, most popular stories you had at Effects Guide actually has been about the work you did on the Tilda Hun, which is a ginormous project. Also done in After Effects, but was that a good test case for this? Did it really help you in attacking this in the Monsters movie as opposed to kind of what you dove into on Attila the Hun?
I guess it did. I guess it did, for sure. But it's funny because there's this like big divide in everyone's mind between TV and film, and don't you dare cross that divide, you know, without the following armor, you know, to protect yourself. And for me, it was a bit like, well, you know, we're working in high def now on TV, which is essentially the same number of pixels as a cinema screen. What's the difference, you know, really? What is the difference? And I found the difference was pretty much going into menus, settings, and changing it to 16-bit. And that was kind of like the biggest difference between TV and film, for me.
Right.
And I approached everything else very similar to how I did TV stuff. And I guess having done things like shows where you have a lot of effects work and, you know, and I'm never, I think everything I do could be a lot better than it is, but it, I kind of knew I could get it to a certain level within like a 6 month period or whatever and do about that number of shots. So it helped me, I guess it helped me have a ballpark handle on not biting off so much that I couldn't like actually do the work later down the line.
So you were doing all this work yourself and working with Premiere. Do you utilize any of the improvements they've done in integration between Premiere and After Effects, kind of since the last time you did Attila the Hun, which didn't have quite the same interactivity between the two apps?
Yeah, I mean, it's you can dynamically link everything. So I would open up the edit that my editor had done for a scene, and basically you can right-click the footage, the clip, and it will open up in After Effects. And then essentially anything you do to it in After Effects will be updated and rendered to the timeline back in Premiere. And the same work is true of Photoshop. You know, you can link, once you embed a Photoshop document in something, as you change it in Photoshop, you can see how it's updated in After Effects. And so it really helps. You know, the way I work is that I'm quite lazy, so I basically approach everything like with what is the minimum effort I can go to get the shot done, as opposed to what is the maximum, which I think other people tend to do. And so it's great because if you go in with minimum effort and everything's linked like that, within an hour of just doing, you know, a really crappy version of something, you can see what it looks like. And it's never as crappy as you think it's going to be. And some elements of it will work fine. And you'll think, oh, that's great, because now I don't need to do that, because you can see it updating as you do it. And so it's just like I'll do a like what you might consider a previs of the shot, mm-hmm. like within the first hour or two, and then basically I spend the rest of the day watching it back, making notes on like a hierarchy of a list of things I'd like to change, going back into After Effects, making all those changes, watching it back again, and just I keep doing that until basically my Excel document says, right, you got to move on to the next shot. And that's just the way I'd work through all the shots in the film.
Well, it's nice because you don't have to manage files and file names and stuff like that. It kind of takes a level of that kind of brain power that you have to spend managing stuff, and you can actually concentrate on the creative aspect too, which is what I like about it.
Yeah, I don't like giving shots numbers. I much prefer them to have names because I can't remember what numbers are.
Well, you're being quite humble about the quality of the effects because they're really outstanding. Were there any particular other tools that were really helpful? I mean, when you were out filming, you're really busy concentrating on the performance as the director, the cameraman, DOP, and the VFX supervisor. Were you worrying about that when you were on set that much? Yeah, were you worrying about the visual effects that much when you were actually filming principal photography?
I was not worrying about it at all because there were so many other things to worry about. It was kind of like, I'll park that problem. And you have to become schizophrenic about it. And so essentially it was like, that's future Gareth's problem. Like, you know, director Gareth, he's worried about, was that in focus? Did the performances work? You know, is the story making sense? And you know, poor old future Gareth's going to have to deal with this crap that I've created for him. And then the problem is 6 months later, you're sitting in your bedroom and I'm cursing director Gareth for filming it so badly. And but in a weird way, I think it works for the film, and in that, when you don't take into account how hard or easy something will be and you just shoot it like it was there, like, and you just don't care and you just film it as if it was really there, there's something subconscious about the way those shots kind of work, in that when you finally do stick it in, it feels like twice as real because you can tell they haven't played it safe, like they've filmed it in a way that makes life really hard. And so it feels like, even though it was painful sometimes to try and make things work, the reward was, it was a lot more rewarding because when you finally did get it to work, it felt more realistic.
You're probably doing stuff with a camera that you'd never advocate someone else to do to you if you're doing the visual effects on a shot, for instance.
Exactly. I mean, with a narrow depth of field, I was doing loads of pull focusing, and so the background would become just a big blurry splodge when you pull from the background to the foreground, and things like that would be, you know, potentially a nightmare to do because you can't track. But thankfully, Mocha, which is part of After Effects, it's like chewing gum. You can just stick to anything, and even if it's completely out of focus, like a lot of these shots were, it would essentially follow the same camera movement. And you'd need to tweak it a bit back in After Effects, like a frame, you know, here and there. But you could get a track out of virtually everything. And
well, so you mentioned Mocha. I mean, obviously that's a tool. Did you do any 3D camera tracking, or did you try and stick to the planar tracker?
Yeah, well, with my lazy, like, minimum effort approach, I tried to always track it in 2D. and only went to 3D tracking if I was really in a pickle. And so there was, I think in the film, there are probably, it might feel like you're looking at, you know, out of 250 shots, it might feel like 50 or 100 were 3D tracks. But and we're going to probably get this wrong, but I believe maybe three were 3D tracks. You know, virtually all of it was 2D cheats, just faking parallax. I found that a lot of the time, if the foreground is moving and the background can be a 2D image, and your brain just interprets it in three dimensions, because there was a couple of occasions where I just couldn't get away with it. Like, there was one shot where there's very surreal things in this infected zone that just make you think, what the hell has gone on here before? One of them is a boat is just in the middle of the trees, like it's been picked up and chucked into the jungle. And we pass by it, and I film it, and I tried my hardest to do that in 2D, like I really did. And it just got to that point where it's like, I'm going to have to get Bougie out or something and have a 3D model and do this. So I couldn't do it with everything, but all the creature stuff, it's all 2D tracking. There was no 3D tracking.
So even the creature, the animation that you did in 3ds Max, those are just 2D tracks.
2D tracks, yeah. There's no 3D tracks ever in any of that.
So I did. So you did the CGA for that as well in the process. What did you prep for After Effects? Did you prep a bunch of different layers? Did you do renders and cell grading? How did you approach that process?
I think my 3D skills are nearly non-existent. Like, I don't really rate my 3D at all, but I'm much
That's
more comfortable. I'm much more comfortable in After Effects.
Right.
And so when it came to the creature, like, in our story, the creatures have to be scary and beautiful. And it was a kind of a contradiction. And it was really hard to come up with a design that could do that. And it took me quite a while to get my head around how I'd never done a proper creature animation of anything. You know, I'd done crude things, little experiments, but it's never really anything I've had to do before. So just learning how to animate that thing, I basically took every cheat I could find. So in 3ds Max, it comes with a plugin called Character Animation Toolkit. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there's preset puppets for different shapes of animals. And obviously mine was a unique looking thing, but I started with a crab. So I picked the crab shape. Mm-hmm. Had to extrapolate and extrude things, but essentially it's that puppet. Then you link it to a node. You can move the node around, and it'll automatically work out all the leg movements. So the thing that became the hardest thing to solve out of my alien character or whatever is it had tentacles, and I really wanted the tentacles to kind of look realistic and a bit mesmerizing and all these sorts of things. And I tried everything, and I really started to panic at one point, like, I'm not going to be able to do this. And I tried all these different tests, and nothing looked any good. And I suddenly remembered that 3ds Max has a simulation for rope in it. And you can basically, you tell it where one end of the rope is and where the other end is, and it works out how the rope would actually physically work, and, you know, depending on where these points are moving. And in the settings, you have things like tension, etc. And one of the settings was gravity. And I just tried turning it off to zero. And suddenly, you run the simulation, and this rope looks like it's in liquid, like zero gravity or underwater. And it looks like this amazing tentacle animation that is actually incredibly simple to do, because you just move one end of the rope, and it calculates it all out. And so then I attached I modeled a tentacle, in a sense. And you can tell it to deform based on the movement of that rope. And so that's how all the tentacles were done. And then really, it looks far more complicated than it is, in that it was all a load of layers put together in After Effects. So I'd try and render as many separate ones as I could, just so I could have more control. Essentially, I'd either do like a backlight render. And the reason I'd separate that out was because there are times when you're compositing and the fact you've got a front light kind of makes it look not very sexy, because maybe there's something bright in the foreground and you're now competing with that, so you want to make the creature black. So that's when I'd pull up the background version of the creature. I mean, the backlight version of the creature. So I basically do like a front light version render, a backlight version render. And then I did, because they're bioluminescent, I basically textured them using real bioluminescent textures from animals. And textured a version of the creature completely as if just purely these textures. It looked like something from Tron by the time I finished. And I'd render that out as a pass. And then what I'd do is I'd use that texture as a matte. So any underneath glowing that would come through, it would come through that texture and look more complicated than it was. And then And then for the actual pulsating of the lights and things, it was mainly like I just shrunk the model to be like just a few polygons, you know, smaller, so that it would fit within the other one. And then basically used a checkered pattern that I just like animated over time, so it'd slowly be moving across the body of the creature. So I'd have this black and white checkerboard version of the creature doing the same animation. And then that would be my starting point in After Effects to colorize it, to flash it on and off. I did random splodges of different areas, and then I would all use that coming through the mat of the bioluminescence layer, which the final effect is really interesting, because the final effect is, it just looks like you're looking at this really complicated 3D model with all these clever little things going on in 3D, and it's all, I'm going to break it all down for the DVD, but I think everyone will be really disappointed at how simple it was, because it's really not as clever as it looks. It's really, really like simple solution.
But therein lies its cleverness. One would say. I was watching it too. I imagine since a lot of the really nice to also work in 16 or even 32. Did you do that to actually help your blooms and glows at all? Because a lot of that felt quite natural. I would
actually work in 8-bit.
Okay.
To just speed it up.
Right.
And then at the last second, I'd hit 16 just before I rendered it. Just because visually, any now and again you see banding.
Yep.
Just very rarely you'd see some banding, and I'd think, oh dear, is that going to be a problem? And I'd just hit 16-bit, and the banding would go. And that just reassured me that it wasn't an issue. And so that's the only, I just turned it on at the end. But the glows and the lights, I mean, I used every trick I could think of. Like, all my background in graphic design, and it's all about contrast and lights and darks, and even the flickering, the fact that it flickers at different rates, and trying to create a contrast on every level, on like in terms of timing on and off being contrasting. If one bit's blue, I'm making the other bit orange, so it's contrasting on the spectrum. You know, if something's backlit, then the other bottom bit is front lit, and so it just constantly, I'm just throwing everything I can think of at it to kind of make it look good. And this, like the new lens flare, is it from Video Copilot?
No, Andrew Kramer's stuff, yeah.
Yeah, they just look beautiful. It's very, very optically correct in terms of matching what was in the camera was actually doing and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, I'm sort of still surprised I got away with it.
Now, during that whole process, were you worried about color management? Were you worried about, because you're finishing, well, talk about your finishing for it and how you approach that, I guess.
I actually understand very little about the end part of the process, other than I would call up the post-production facility who were going to be onlining and grading it and everything and say, okay, what file do you want? And they'd say, Cinian. And I'd go, okay, I can't find that. And it's a DPX. Okay, so what's Cinian then? It's a setting within DPX. Okay. What kind of, there's something saying color space. What should I have? You should have linear. Okay. So basically, it was like a little conversation like that. And I did the selection of the settings that they said, and it never went wrong. And so I really don't understand what any of that means, really. And I'm kind of want to keep it that way. So I just like do the work, and then at the end, there'll be these pre-settings that I knew was their favorite settings of choice, and I'd just default to that every time I rendered something.
So, and you did a post-grade on it. What, at HD res, is that what you render everything at?
Yeah, so it was all 1920 by 1080. We did it at essentially 24p, or 23.976, or whatever.
Right.
Adam Inglis was our main colorist on it, and he did a great job, and It was really interesting, because I thought, you know, because we'd shot on this prosumer stuff, that we were going to be in a lot of trouble trying to grade it. And he was always amazed at how much we got out of the shadows. I mean, in terms of all the, we shot in a lot of available light. I'd say possibly 90% of the film is available light. And we didn't light much. And so I was nervous, like, yeah, it's all looking good to me, but wait till we get in front of an oscilloscope, you know, like my nemesis.
Right.
And they're going to suddenly tell me, we can't release this movie. And but no, we totally all worked really well. And I was really amazed like how good it looked on the big screen.
Well, I actually loved the film. I loved its use of visual effects in the film to drive the narrative, as opposed to the visual effects just driving the budget or the or something for the film. But there's been a lot of talk about this kind of rebel filmmaking. I know Stu Mashwitz is a big proponent of talking about it, but how do you see this kind of balance on what you did versus the big studios? I mean, should they be worried?
I think there's two sides to the business model. And like on one side, you've got Avatar, and it's the most expensive movie ever made, made the more money than any movie ever made. So it feels like that side is safe. And then on the other side, you've got, if you make a film for under $1 million or whatever it is, and you get a distribution deal, you're always going to turn a profit. So that side's safe. I think it's the middle ground that's problematic. But it's funny because I get worried. Like, it's kind of like some people think when you do visual effects from home, and I guess what that means is it's quite cheap, that somehow you're sort of making a problem for the industry in a way. And for me, it's like I believe that most people who are in this business who do visual effects for a living, they're in it really because they want to make movies, and I'm pretty sure you speak to anybody, they don't want to be rotoscoping until they're 50 or 60. It's like they're doing it as a stopgap so that they can become filmmakers, or at least I know I did. I know all my friends were like that as well in visual effects. And so in a way, I feel like instead of like this idea that, doing visual effects and then making a film and doing your own visual effects, that's bad for the industry. I feel like it's more like, no, it's a good thing, because now visual effects people, they should all go and make movies themselves. It's like these big, these big post-production facilities. I don't understand why. The reason people go and see these films is because of the amazing spectacle that they create.
Right.
It's like, why don't they just go make films on their own? Why are they waiting for Hollywood to sign a check? Why don't they take ownership, raise the money somehow, and go make a movie? And that's what I'm advocating. A lot more that than the other way around, which is, I'm not trying to put anyone out of business. I'm trying to create a new business, which is, let's all go make movies. This is why we're here. This is why we're interested in it. This is why I love films, was the idea of being a filmmaker one day. It's the only appeal to me as of visual effects is it's just an amazing tool to tell stories with. And I think it's cool in terms of the industry as well. It's like, I think we've sort of done ourselves got ourselves into a bit of a pickle, because we do things like we call it CGI, like computer generated imagery. Like, computers just generate this stuff, like people don't. And we don't call camera footage, like rushes, we don't call that camera generated imagery. Like, everyone understands the process. They know it was a person that did that and made it look good. And it sort of feels like, I kind of wish like companies would brag less about the proprietary software they've written and more about the staff they employ and how talented they are and things like that. And so it's just, there are a lot of talented people out there. And I think if anything comes from this film at all, if it just inspires anybody listening to go pick up a camera and make a film, then I feel like we've had a success.
Well, the point is, I think that technology is there to enable people to do that now. It's in their hands to be able to do it. Now it just takes the artist to do it. Because I would say there are fewer people who can do what you do, I think, though, in your directing, writing effectively, visual effects, and compositing skills. That's a pretty vast tool set. And to be able to do all those really well is a barrier to entry to making your own film, I think.
It's strange because I think actually in a weird way, they're all one and the same. In that, like, there's like a fractal thing that goes on where a rule that applies to just one shot kind of is the same rule that applies to a whole film, in that, it's all, ultimately, it's all about balancing, like, you're attracted to areas of contrast. So it's about creating contrast, but balancing it out. And it feels like that's true of composition. It's true of when you create characters in a story. It's true of music and things like this. And so it all feels strange, and I haven't quite nailed it in my own head, but it all feels like it's all one and the same in a weird way. And it's kind of weird because my background in visual effects, I actually thought I'd wasted, I only got into it to make films, and
right.
I felt like I'd wasted 5-10 years of my life learning how to do computer graphics. And my bad analogy is that it's like the scene from Karate Kid where he has to wax on, wax off, and he does it over and over and over, and he's thinking, why the hell am I doing this? This is boring. And then suddenly he goes to punch him and he can block it perfectly. And he's like, that's why I did it. And so doing visual effects is like the wax on and wax off of filmmaking. It's like such a painful way and boring way to learn about what makes an image look good or bad. Like, if you're a cameraman and you do a bad composition, you can fix it within a few seconds. You just move the camera slightly. If you're a visual effects person and you do a bad composition, you can waste the whole day. Like, you could do a painting, but at the end of it, you look at it and go, you know what, that's just the wrong angle. I've got to redo it all. So it's such a painful way to learn about what makes something look right that when you finally pick up a camera, I just felt so liberated making this film. It was like the camera should have had a sticker on it saying like real-time rendering or something.
Right.
It was like wherever I moved, it updated instantly. It's amazing. And so it was certainly, in retrospect, it was the best for me, it was the best route into filmmaking I could have had. It really worked out later down the line in terms of, A, it empowers you. You can create anything you want. No one can tell you you can't. And B, a lot of the rules you subconsciously develop in your head as to what things, why things do and don't work, seem to apply to other aspects of filmmaking. So,
yeah, that's true. Well, you mentioned the word cheap, and I know you didn't mean it that way, but the visual effects certainly don't look cheap. The film looks way more expensive than I can imagine what it cost in the end. It looked very polished, professional, so certainly not cheap, but inexpensive. Visual effects.
It actually cost $150 million. For the budget, but we spent $149 million digitally removing all the crew out of the background, out of the behind the scenes footage, so that it looked like it was just me.
Yeah, like a reality show on TV. Now, if someone wants to see the film, where's the best place for them to actually check it out?
There are a few options. Obviously, the theater in the cinema would be great if they could go there. But that's essentially, so it's going to be released in the United States on Halloween. In New York and Los Angeles, and then it's going to platform out the next week into other major cities, and it'll just hopefully go from there, whatever it does. And then around different territories around the world, it's essentially, depending on where you live, it's going to be different times, but pretty much end of October to beginning of December, somewhere around the world, hopefully you'll be able to see it in the cinema. And if not, it's available on iTunes as of now in HD.
It looks fantastic.
And you saw it that way last night,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it really looks fantastic and
not
overly compressed. But again, congratulations on it. And again, look forward to actually hopefully doing more about Monsters, maybe breaking down some behind the scenes and visual effects kind of coming up in the future on FX Guy TV with you.
Cool, thank you.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank Gareth there for a really, really insightful look at the film industry, and also actually thank John because I think it was a great interview. As we mentioned, Gareth had actually previously taught over at FX PhD, and we have new courses going there at the moment on independent filmmaking. In fact, a new term has just started, so if you're into indie film, you might want to check out some of the courses, including one I'm involved in, which is to do with shooting scripted comedy drama using DSLRs. Also, I just want to do a bit of cross-promotion and let you know that our Red Center podcast is hugely successful. We'll be covering shooting in London, some independent film work with the new Spheron HDR camera in an upcoming podcast. At FX Guide TV, we've been looking at Legends of the Guardians, and we're about to look at deep compositing and kind of have a real kind of behind-the-scenes technical look at that. Also, check out, if you're interested, the FX Guide TV Espanol, the Spanish version, which covers completely different material to the English version, stuff that's being produced in the Spanish-speaking community worldwide. And then just on the standard FX Guide site, there are a lot of really good stories coming up, and there's a terrific one about to come out on the movie reshaping tool to do with some research we published at SIDGRAPH Asia, as well as a whole lot of films and material coming from our writers at FX Guide. And look, we'll be covering a lot of stuff in the period coming up to Christmas, but I did want to flag the fact that we will be going to SIDGRAPH Asia and covering more stuff from up there. Anyway, check out all of our podcasts, and thank you so much for listening to this, and thank you again to Gareth and John. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. On behalf of Jeff, myself, and John, thanks so much for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.